I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Craig Allen. He's a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he's station leader of the Hemez Mountains Field Station based at Bandelier National Monument. He will be giving a talk titled Fires, Floods, and Climate Change in Relation to New Mexico's Forests tomorrow, Tuesday, the 15th of October at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. This is part of the Amigos Bravos Water Matters lecture series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Morning, MC.
So you've been studying forests since the 1980s and noticing the many different kinds of changes that we've seen in the forest over the last three decades. You've mostly been looking in the Southwest, is that correct?
Yeah, I've actually been based in the Hemez Mountains throughout that time. Since 1982, I did both my master's and PhD studying how the landscape had changed historically through time. So for the last hundreds or thousands of years, as context for what we're seeing going on today.
What are we seeing? How has the forest changed?
Well, the big changes here, it's a combination of land use histories, climate, natural climate variability. The Southwest naturally has wet periods and dry periods. And now we also have trends in climate, basically warming on top of all of that. And what's going on today reflects the interaction of all of those things sort of coming together. And so anyway, the forest has changed a surprising amount in the last 120 years in New Mexico.
Is that due in large part to fires, wildfires?
Yeah, well, the history of fire, but fire, today people tend to think of fire as the Smokey Bear image of it as that's been drilled into us as a bad thing. That's a destructive force, but fire it's a fire planet. In a way, where you have things that grow in oxygen, fire is a natural process. And so these forests and much of the vegetation evolved and developed with fire. But people, we've changed the way fire behaves on our landscapes through the way we've used the land the last 120 or so years.
One of the things that we've done, which has caused more fires, is suppressing fires.
Right.
How does that work?
Well, that's a big part of the story. So we can reconstruct the history of fire for 400 to 500 years using the record in tree rings. And there's been an immense amount of that research done here in northern New Mexico, particularly in the Hemez Mountains, but some in the Sangre de Cristos. So we can see that there's this history of frequent surface fires, say in Ponderosa Pine Forest in particular, where every 5 to 12 or so years, a fire would burn through these forests repeatedly, but they're burning on the ground. These were surface fires burning in grassy fuels, pine needles, and the forests, and this pattern of frequent surface fire kept the forest more open, more park-like. This is sort of the stereotype of how forests were in the Southwest, and for most forests, it seems to be true.
Now, you say that it was ground fires, so the trees themselves weren't burning down?
Not the mature trees. But what it did do, these surface fires, a young ponderosa pine tree is vulnerable until it's about 15 years old. It's vulnerable to being killed when it's little. Once it's about 15, they're actually very resistant to these surface fires. Their bark gets thick quickly, and so they survive. But meanwhile, when they're little, they would be thinned out. When those fires stopped in the late 1800s, all those little baby pine trees could mature and get big, and that's what's happened. So we went from something on the order of 50 to 150 trees per acre, say 100 trees per acre in ponderosa pine systems, many, the more productive ones, to more than 1,000 trees per acre over the course of the last century.
So when you have fire suppression, we've had that for, what, 100 years?
Right. Well, so the history there is that actually, in the late 1800s, when railroads linked northern New Mexico to the outside world economically, which the railroad reached the Chile line, reached Santa Fe, Española, and then Santa Fe in 1880. In the decade of the 1880s, the livestock population exploded in northern New Mexico as people from the outside invested in commercial production, not subsistence production of animals. By the 1890 census, there were like 5 million sheep and 1.5 million cattle and hundreds of thousands of horses and burros grazing in open range conditions, no permits, across the landscape. And they ate the grassy fuels that carried the surface fires. So what we see is this history of fire in the tree rings that goes back 400, 500 years. that it stops in the 1880s and 1890s before deliberate suppression of fire. It was an accidental outcome of landscape-wide overgrazing.
Very interesting.
And we can even go back farther. Working with other colleagues, we have reconstructed histories back 15,000 years of fire in northern New Mexico, southern Colorado, looking at the charcoal record in lakes and bogs. So in the sediments that accumulate in these lakes and bogs, you can see the layers of charcoal. And what we see is that, which goes back into the last glacial period, we come out of that 12,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, and by 9,000 years ago, the modern southwest climate with dry spring, early summer, and monsoonal onset, thunderstorms, lots of lightning. By 9,000 years ago, we see that there's an immense amount of charcoal throughout the last 9,000 years, except at the very top of these cores, the last 120 or so years. So this absence of fire through suppression, at first accidental, and then after 1910, it was a deliberate policy by land managers to suppress fire, basically meant for most of the last 120 years, we've been able to keep fires down. That's an anomaly on a time scale of many thousands of years, not even just hundreds.
What was the rationale for the fire suppression policy?
Well, prior to 1910, from the late 1800s into the early 1900s, there was a debate by foresters and ecologists about whether fire was a good or a bad thing. We could see we had these beautiful forests of old trees that we inherited from nature with the presence of fire. But foresters said, well, we could grow more trees on these sites if fire wasn't thinning the young ones so much. Well, the foresters were quite right about that.
For the purposes of logging?
Well, for the purposes, of growing wood and managing the forest. That was the mindset at the time. It came out of sort of this German forestry developed in Central Europe in places like Germany and Switzerland, and so where they carefully regulated these forests for centuries. But what really drove it, what the policy change developed out of 1910, there was a very severe fire year across the West, particularly in the Northern Rockies, that killed hundreds of people. And that pushed the policy debate, which had been kind of like, maybe fire is not such a bad thing, well, but it's dangerous and it thins, kills trees. It became part of the core mission of the Forest Service, which was a brand new agency, only 5 years old in 1910. And so that drove, basically the Forest Service took that on as a mission to suppress fires as a core part of their mission after that. But it was a political change that drove that because of
right. All
the people that died.
We're talking to Craig Allen, research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. When you have natural fires occurring, as they do, over in the Southwest, as you say, over the course of 9,000 years, and in the presentation that you're going to be giving, people can see these maps of what fires we've had over decades, and a few dots here, a few dots there, during the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, and the 80s was pretty wet. And then the 90s, 2000s, and 2010s, you have these gigantic, huge swaths of fires that are happening here just in this area, in the area that you're studying, the Valles Caldera, the Jemez, here in northern New Mexico. That is a result of what combination of factors?
Yeah, well, prior to 1900, the fire was very frequent and very widespread. A point to emphasize is that it's not even the area of the fires that's burning that burns today, these big 100,000-acre fires. As ecologists, we're not so concerned about how big that area is, but more about how big the high-severity patches are in that. Prior to 1900, people talk about, 2000 or 2002 as the worst fire years in New Mexico history, or Las Conchas is the biggest fire ever. We know that's not true, actually. We know that from the history of fire scars, that many years in the past, whole mountain ranges were on fire, pre-1900, but they were largely a surface fire. High elevation forests, stand replacing fire, so-called catastrophic fire, places where you see aspen stands on the landscape, that kind of stand replacing fire is natural there. And we've been reconstructing that through tree ring methods too. But those are relatively small parts of the forests in the Southwest. Just sort of the tops of our mountains are these high enough, wet enough places where fire was infrequent but severe when it burned in the past. Most of the forest landscape in the Southwest had these fires, say every decade or so. And there would be years whole mountain ranges were burning. 1748, we're quite confident, was the most widespread fire year in the whole region. We can see almost the entire Hamas Mountains was burning that year from the records of fire in the trees, and almost every mountain range in the Southwest was similarly on fire that year. So there was this history of climate. Dry years that followed wet years were the really big fire years pre-1900. But again, think surface fire. The wet years, the grass would grow well. There would be a lot of continuity of those grassy fuels. A dry year would come. Lightning would ignite some fires, and they would burn for months without people putting them out. So huge areas would burn, but it's not killing the mature trees.
And so that's why we even have tree ring data. I mean, the kinds of severe fires that we've had lately, there's no trees with rings left to tell the foresters of the future what even happened.
It's a true point. In the Hamas, in the last 17 years, I mean, I've sampled, I don't know how many sites overall in the Hamas, probably on the order of 60 localities in the Hamas since the mid-80s. We've lost, in the last 17 years, we've lost 15 of those sites that recorded high-frequency surface fire pre-1900. We've lost 15 of those sites to stand replacing fire. We know on those where it's killed all the trees. These are 300, 400-year-old trees, and they've all been killed on these sites. So as you say, that record, we know this is a huge anomaly at that time scale.
We attribute this to a combination of things: fire suppression, drought, and climate change. It's sort of like the perfect storm.
Right. So again, relative to drought and climate, it's important to note that what's normal in the Southwest is a lot of variability in precipitation through time. And again, we can reconstruct this with tree rings going back for more than 2,000 years, because there's old wood on parts of the landscape, and we can see trees grow better in wet years than dry years. And so you can get this record, this long record. So we know drought is very natural in this region. And in the wet periods, things fluff up and grow better. And in the dry periods, it can't support as dense a forest. But in the absence of fire, the forests have been, in the last 100 years, when we took fire out of the system successfully for about 80 years, the fuels just, the forest kept getting thicker and thicker. And in that period, there was a wet period in the early 1900s, the 1920s and 20s, when a lot of baby trees established, no fire to thin them out. We had a dry period in the 1950s, a drought similar to the drought we're in now. There was more fire activity, but the forests weren't quite thick enough that the firefighters were still able to suppress most of those fires. Then we went into a wetter period again, and I arrived early in the really wet part of that period. So from the late 70s to 95, there was one of the best periods of tree growth in the last 1,000 years, we can see from tree rings. That wet period allowed two things to happen. One, the forest got super thick because it's had 80 years of lots of trees to grow up, and the fuels to build on the forest floor, and the ladder fuels, the small trees that let fires climb the ladder from burning on the surface, but they can get into the canopy where the whole fire behavior changes.
That's when it goes really bad.
Those are the kind of fires that when extreme fuels are burning in extreme weather, those kind of fires create their own weather, and we really can't. We have to wait till the fuels or the weather changes. We can't even slow those fires down, basically. But the other thing that happened, that wet period let the forest fluff up, and it was wet enough that the firefighters could keep a lid on the fires through 95. But since 96, we started to go into this drought period that we're still in. And with the first dry winter, the winter of 95-96, that next spring and summer, we started to pop big fires in the Southwest, which have continued to grow larger year by year, almost year by year, but every dry year as it's gotten drier and warmer. And so that's the other piece of this, is that the drought we're in arguably could be just completely natural, and there's a certain amount of oscillation driven by the oceans. So patterns of temperature in the Pacific and the Atlantic drive where the jet stream pushes our winter storms. What's different now is that this is a warmer drought than it's been in the past. because, and this is where the climate
change
comes in.
Yeah,
so because it's been warming globally, but particularly in the Southwest and the West, it's been warming even more than the rest of North America recently.
And those are essentially unfightable fires.
Again, there's an immense amount of successful fire suppression activity that still takes place. Almost all fires are still attacked and successfully contained to very small areas. But when you get an ignition occurring in these extreme fuels during extreme fire weather periods, you get extreme fire behavior.
And it's like Las Conchas.
Like Las Conchas, which was just extraordinary, and nobody alive in New Mexico has seen fire behavior like that. That fire started, a little aspen tree blew over on a little power line on the south side of the Valles Caldera, just a little line servicing a few inholdings in Forest Service land, at about 1 p.m. on Sunday, 26 June 2011, and in the next 14 hours it burned 43,000 acres. Almost an acre a second in that first afternoon evening.
An acre a second.
Almost.
Ladies and gentlemen, just stop for a moment and try to contemplate an acre a second. I mean, when I think about the acres that I know, it's like...
That's an acre is about a football field.
An acre is a football field.
And again, it isn't even so much the area burned as the fact that almost all of that burning in that first day was tree-killing fire. So,
right.
So that left just that first day... First afternoon and evening run left an area. There's about a 30,000 acre hole where all the mature trees were killed. And this is another one of the issues and concerns that many people have these days with these high severity fires, is that the trees here, things like ponderosa pine, they can't regenerate unless some other trees survive in the areas that burn. That's how ponderosa pine evolved and developed. It's surface fire, the mature trees survive, and they're able to seed enough. Sure, a few trees would be killed, mature trees in fires in the past, of course, but not even, we don't have evidence even of patches of hundreds of acres in ponderosa pine forest in the Southwest, pre-1900. And now we're not getting just thousands of acres a size and patch, but tens of thousands of acres where every tree is killed. So what we're getting is grasses and shrubs coming back in these places rather than the conifer trees that have been there for probably thousands of years.
How does that kind of fire affect the soil?
Well, there's many impacts, of course, from that. Part of the impact is the severity of burning right at the soil surface from 100 years of buildup of plant material, dead plant material, that in the past would have been recycled more frequently. But when it builds up for a century and then it burns on a really hot, severe fire day, it generates a big heat pulse that kills a lot of the... Soils are alive, so there's an immense amount of life in the top portion of the soil, but it...
Microbial life,
little invertebrates, all the things...
Worms.
All of these things in the top portion. People talk about sites being sterilized by high-severity fire. That's a little strong, but it really knocks back the biological capital of these sites. Is really, a lot of it is killed. Literally, a lot of it incinerated. All that organic matter, a lot of it's incinerated.
So that affects, I mean, not only the fact that these ponderosa pines have been killed by fire, but even if there were a few seeds hanging around, it would be hard to regenerate anything in that kind of soil.
And basically, the seeds don't survive in either a soil seed bank or a canopy seed bank. Whereas farther north in the Rockies, one of the dominant tree species is lodgepole pine, where the seeds are actually protected in cones that open after the fire burns through. It melts the kind of the resin that holds, seals the cone together, and the trees reseed immediately after the burn, and you get big thickets of forest coming back, right back after. Our trees don't do that here because it was a different kind of fire pattern naturally here in most of our forest.
We're talking to research ecologist Craig Allen. We've been talking about catastrophic fires as opposed to natural fires, and natural fires have a way of actually helping the forest to stay healthy and the soils to stay healthy and the burned charcoal actually gives some minerals back to the soil, and trees can regenerate, and life goes on, and wildlife continues, and so on. When you've got these big catastrophic fires, the soil is dead, the trees are dead, and then there's also serious erosion and flooding.
When high-severity fire burns through a stand that hasn't seen fire in 100 years, it incinerates the sponge, the biological sponge, which is modulating, slowing the flow of water from precipitation. So, which in two ways. One, when you got a live tree canopy, it's intercepting the rain. Think thunderstorm, right? Big, heavy rains come down. A lot of it's intercepted in the canopies of the trees. But even more so, there's this sponge of the dead plant material, what we call litter, but it's not a bad thing, like like plastic wrappers, but
right.
But the buildup of dead plant mulch. Think of it as mulch. That's really what it is. So that mulching of all the dead plant material that formerly was recycled more frequently, but not so extremely. But in the last century, we've gotten used to the idea that these forests, since they weren't burning, would do this sponging, have this sponging effect on when precipitation would come, and so the water would be captured and infiltrate slowly into the soil and not run off on the surface. But when you incinerate that surface mulch and the canopy, when the rain comes, it actually seals the pores in the soil, and it runs off. They start to behave, especially if there's steep slopes, they start to behave almost like parking lots for the first year or two until plants can start to grow back on these sites. And so you get a lot of water runoff, and the water runoff has a lot of energy, and so it's moving soil and debris off of these steep slopes. And so that's where we're seeing big floods and what are called debris flows, which are almost more like slurry that have all this soil and rock and logs and everything else, a lot of energy generated in these things that we haven't seen for the last century. So,
and where does all that stuff go?
Downhill.
Downhill and into streams, into people's
streams,
yards, whatever.
Well, depending on where they are, but it ends up in, of course, in the major river systems, ultimately a lot of it. So there are all the little tributary streams in the Jemez, tributaries of the Rio Grande. There are new deltas where there's deposits at the mouth of these rivers where all the sediment come in and it's being dumped as it hits the Rio Grande. And then, of course, it has effects on water quality downstream. During, after the Las Conchas fire, Albuquerque had to shut its water intakes on the Rio Grande for 40 days because there was so much material, charcoal and sediment, that it would have clogged up their system. Santa Fe, similarly, you know, in the last few years has started to divert water from Buckman out of the Rio Grande as part of the drinking water supply. They had it shut for 20 days.
So this really affects our water supply.
Yeah, a lot. People are starting to see that in the valleys, I guess the real point of it, of your question is, where does it go? That people, our human societies, we're living primarily down in valley situations and using the water, but we're connected to the mountain forests, the upland watersheds. They're connected from top to bottom. And when these high severity fires happen, we're seeing those effects throughout the length of these watersheds, including down where we're living.
What are some of the effects on the wildlife in the forests, and compare that to a natural fire versus these current present day catastrophic fires?
I want to say something I want to remember is that even these so-called catastrophic fires, large fractions of the area burned. When you hear Las Conchas fire was 156,000 acres, at least half of that was actually good fire, right, where it's burning in ways we would, more natural ways that are actually reducing the density of the forest but not killing every tree.
Right, those healthy natural fires. So some of the Las Conchas fire was that.
And that's true for all of these so-called catastrophic fires. So it's important to remember that. I'm a little sensitive to the word catastrophic,
yeah,
because although it's anomalously severe in these big high-severity patches, but fire is... Anyway, it's doing some good. So these fires are doing some good on these landscapes as well.
So it sounds like, I mean, half is and half isn't.
Something like that. Actually, until recently, a lot of the fires, it was only about a third of the area that you would see reported. Only about a third of it would be these high-severity patches.
Right.
And more like two-thirds of it was either barely burning at all or was doing burning at a nice moderate level.
So, I mean, then you can look at one of these so-called catastrophic fires where half of it is a natural and healthy fire, the other half is not. In those two areas, when you compare them, what are the effects on wildlife?
Well, you get really different outcomes. I mean, there's winners and losers, which is another, I guess, thing to say, that when you hear fires reported, people often say 10,000 acres destroyed by fire such and such. Well, actually, no acre is destroyed. All those acres are still there. Something will grow back. It may be less productive. It may be very different species. But at that level, nature is, at a core level, resilient that way. But if we change the way fire behaves on the landscape by the way we manage, which we have done, we do get different outcomes than what we're used to and what we value. So, from a wildlife standpoint, if you get grasses and shrubs back instead of trees, you get the wildlife species back that value grasses and shrubs. So things like Abert squirrels, you know, the cute little gray tassel-eared squirrels, those are specialists on ponderosa pine trees. Crown fire is not a good thing for Abert squirrels in those crown fire patches, at least not until forests come back. And in some of these places, we don't think forests are coming back for centuries, essentially not ever, given the way climate is changing. But if you're band-tailed pigeons that are using acorns from oaks that have resprouted and come up in, this is not a bad thing. For deer and elk, animals like that are kind of using more early the plants that grow up in open areas. You know, they think fire is great.
Now, deer and elk and bears, or squirrels for that matter, but some of these larger mammals, in a fire that's spreading at one football field a second, they're not going to be able to escape and go someplace else.
Certainly direct impacts when you have that kind of freight train of a fire moving so rapidly through the system. So there's definitely some direct mortality, which kills individuals, but the populations tend to be pretty resilient.
So they come and regenerate.
Right. But there are species, I mean, that need forest. You know, and these are some of the species that get listed. You know, increasingly some of the listings for animals on the Endangered Species Act are because of concerns over loss of forest habitat. Things like Mexican spotted owl, things like Haymas mountain salamander, a wonderful little terrestrial salamander that actually lives basically in the soil, but it breathes through its skin, it's lungless, it needs moist conditions. And if you lose the forest cover completely, the tendency is for the soil to dry out more, and we think this is probably not good in the long run for salamander populations. And then the only place in the whole world this little animal lives, as far as we know, is in the Haymas Mountains. So,
very interesting. Craig Allen is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's station leader of the Haymas Mountain Field Station based at Bandelier National Monument. And once again, he will be giving a lecture titled Fires, Floods, and Climate Change in Relation to New Mexico's Forests on Tuesday, that's tomorrow, the 15th of October at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. That's located at 501 Helena Street on the corner of Helena and Paseo de Peralta. It's part of the Amigos Bravos Water Matters Lecture Series. For more information, you can go to amigosbravos.org. Craig Allen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're most welcome, Nancy.